Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart. To many in the West, Russia is a country to be scorned, loathed, condemned, and above all, feared. But to my guest today, this isn't a recent phenomenon, but something that Western elites have cultivated and weaponized since the Great Schism of Christianity. Why? What purpose does it serve? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Guy Mitton, a Swiss politician and author of Creating Russophobia, From the Great Religious Schism to Anti-Putin Hysteria. Mr. Mitton, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you to you for inviting me.
Now, in your book, you argue that Russophobia is not just an expedient political tactic, but something far more structural and fundamental. You suggest that it's part of the West's quest for its own identity, that Byzantium and later Russia have served the roles of involuntary sparring partners for the West, which is... also, in a way, doing the West a favor because we all grow through frustration, both on the collective and individual levels. I wonder, though, why do you think this favor isn't being appreciated and why has it been lasting for so long?
Yes, as I tried to explain in my book, that's a very long history, a thousand years history, and the present Russophobia is very deeply rooted in the history and can be explained by the first religious schism between the Catholic Church, Rome, let's say, and the Byzantine Church, the Orthodox Church, at the end of the 9th century, beginning of 9th century, Emperor Charles the Great, and the official schism at the 11th century. Why? Because since this time, it's a question of identity, as you mentioned, for the West, because the legitimate empire at the time was the Byzantine Empire with Constantinopolis as capital. And Rome had disappeared from the scene since five centuries. So it was a kind of rebellion against the legitimate king, the legitimate emperor at the time. That's why for the West, not only a religious problem, but also a political one, how to try to become independent and to have their own identity against Orthodox and Byzantines.
What I found very interesting in your book is that you actually claim that the West quest for an identity that has never been found. So your argument is that the West has never been able to find its identity. And historically, it's a rather provocative statement because the West went through the classical Greek and Roman periods. This is where Christianity found its home. You know, it went through the Renaissance. It still claims the exclusive rights to all kinds of enlightenment, be it political, economic, gender relations, etc. What makes you believe that the Western identity has never been found?
The Western identity is multiple. Is not one that's multiple, because you have the Italian Renaissance, you have the French, you have the Spaniards at the beginning. Now they disappeared quite fast, but also the German and the Anglo-Saxon for sure. So it was always a multiple identity. So it's more difficult to elaborate an identity when it is multiple, when it is, dispersed. That's the first thing. And the second, that's because of this difficulty that the West needed always an enemy. So the enemy was the Orthodox in terms of religions, was the Tsar of Basileus of Byzantine, And after that, after the collapse of Byzantine Empire, this arch enemy has been found with Russia. You understand? The figure, the image of the enemy helped to maintain this multiple identity together, if I can summarize like that. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned in the book the separation of the Roman Empire into Western and Eastern Byzantine parts, and it wasn't historically, it wasn't only, let's say, a religious question. It became a religious question later, but at the time of separation, it was also a philosophical question, a statehood question, because these two parts, former parts of the Roman Empire, treated that expansion in a very different way. The West expanded through conquest and forceful imposition of its rules, its morality onto other peoples. And the Byzantine Empire expanded through integration without demanding of change of a worldview or change of religious affiliation. I wonder if we are seeing this division being replayed once again in history, because if you look at Russia right now, it's a federal state, but it's a very diverse state, and people within it live very, very different lives, not only religiously, but also technologically, economically, etc. But the West demands uniformity within its community.
We should say that every empire is beginning at the beginning, is a conquering empire, including Russia, because Russia is also, from the 16th century to the 19th century, advanced by conquering new territories on Europe. But the big difference is that Russia has integrated these new cultures, new religion inside its empire, which was not the case of the Western powers. The colonization, the recent colonization, the 19th century colonization is an example. They never tried to integrate the new peoples into their republic, but they just applied the white Western rule to everybody, and it's completely a different way. That's with racism, or apartheid, things like that, which was not the case of the Russian who were able to do it. And if you look at the present American policy, Anglo-Saxon policy, that's exactly the same. That's why also United States lose all its wars, because it's able to conquest, it's able to make the victory on the battleground against Iraq, Libya, and Syria, or other countries to destroy, but is unable to convince the people to join them.
Doesn't that make it the core principle of the Western identity, being able to come in and enforce or subjugate other people, regardless of what happens later on? Just this demonstration of brutal force, being able to conquer.
Exactly, because there is in the West a kind of conviction, of certitude, that the Western values are above all other ones. So the Western philosophy, the Western way of thinking, philosophy, science is so superior, is so much higher than everybody else, that the West has the right to dominate, to be suprematist, let's say like that, which is not the case of other nations or other civilizations. And that's why the West is so, keen to impose its own rules to everybody else, which is not, as we said, the case of Russian or even Chinese or other civilization. The Arabs, they did it during a few centuries after the at the beginning of the Islam, but after that, they stop it, but not the West, you know. And we can see now how convictions are so strong and still at work in the world. That's why also now United States and the Western world cannot accept that any other countries wish also to appear on the world scene. They cannot accept the idea of multipolarity.
Absolutely, but I think what they cannot accept is not just multipolarity, but that other countries have their own identity. And unlike in case with the West, that identity is pretty solid. I mean, it may not be as progressive, it may not change every decade. It's rooted usually culturally and historically, but it's pretty firm. I wonder if that in and of itself is the biggest sort of psychological or metaphysical challenge to the West, that other countries can be themselves with, you know, the good and the bad parts that they have.
Yeah. Yes. We mentioned, for instance, Carl Jung, you know, the Swiss psychologist who has analyzed the deep psyche of the human being. And I think that's right. I think in the deep psyche, in the deep soul of the Westerners, there is this certitude not to be God, but to be the only delegate of God on this earth, having the power to impose and to oblige the other people to share the views, you know. And that's in so deeply rooted that I see when I speak with my colleagues here, with other people in the West, when we have round tables, they are so convinced to possess, to have the right. That's so rooted, they are not aware, they are not conscious of this kind of thinking. And that's the problem. That's why also in the West, every action is based on a kind of God, of good and evil, you know. All events, or historical events, or political events, you know, are analyzed through this kind of framework, you know, good and evil. We are the good, we are the only owners of the good, and all the people who are disagreeing with us, they are the evil. So that's why Russia and now China, since 20 years, China, Iran, and other countries are the axis of evil. So that's very dangerous to think like that, but that's the case now.
I see. Well, what is also the case right now, Mr. Mitten, is that we have to take a very short break, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Guy Mitten, a Swiss politician and author of Creating Russophobia, From the Great Religious Schism to Anti-Putin Hysteria. Mr. Mitten, before the break, you mentioned this almost hysterical reaction that mentioning of, modest common sense cooperation with Russia gets. You also make a point in the book that admitting that Russia might be right even a little bit on something is perceived as an attack on the West's deepest identity. And I think that very much describes the condition of a malignant narcissism, which is ultimately an infantile condition. It's a child condition, you know, the condition that a childish part of the psyche has. But the problem with it is that it's not really prone to any transformation. It demands only what it wants. And if it doesn't get what it wants to burn everything down. It would not let anyone else exist. And the question that I have here, if you agree with this analogy, is, you know, what can we do ultimately? Because Russia, China, and, you know, more than 100 other countries will not give up on their right to live on this planet and on their right to be who they are. But it seems that the very fact of existing and living out your own life is already perceived as a, you know, existential threat to the people in the West, or to the politicians in the West, rather.
No, I think your image of the young child, the selfish child, you know, just asking for more and more and more, you know, things, gifts and so on, is completely correct. If we can apply that to the Western mind, you know, and way of thinking, that's a good image. But because as we said, since centuries now, since the Renaissance, since the conquest of South America, Latin America by the Spaniards, you know, the starting of the Western colonization, this feeling of superiority is so deeply rooted, anchored in the way that's very difficult for the Western people to think differently. And, you know, in that sense, Russia is the perfect or the arch enemy, because Russia is so big. When you look on the maps, and every Westerner or politician or geopoliticist have as a map of the world, you know, and you see this so big country in the north, you know, waiting of the rest of the world, and they are looking that that's the, for them, the complete nightmare, you know.
But Mr. Mitton, this is not the only thing. I mean, I think it's not just a matter of size, because anyone who's been to Russia or China would see that the Western portrayal of those countries is very different from realities. These countries are actually trying to give their people, you know, an ample degree of public goods. It's not just about the size, but it's also about the services that are provided for the people.
That's right. But, you know, it is a threat not only by the size, but also by what these, let's say, countries like Russia or China can provide to the rest of the world. Not in terms of manufacture or goods, you know, physical goods, but also in terms of spirit, of civilization, of other principles of living. And that's why it's so dangerous. For instance, you know, the values that actually Russia is proposing, you know, let's say the respect of the gender of a woman and man, and you know, the no, not wokeism ideology, this kind of thing is perceived as very dangerous for the West. That's why also that's another case for fighting against Russia, China, and other civilizations. Because they are now able not only to compete in terms of economy, of natural resource, but also in terms of mind, of vision of the man, you know, the humankind, and so on. And that's why now the tensions are so high, because the West is now in rivalry in terms of philosophy, morals, principles, and so on.
You know, I sometimes have a feeling that the West is fighting not only with Russia and China, but actually it's trying to fight with reality. And one example of that would be this very curious phenomenon that we are now observing in the West, when history, even the deepest history, you know, like centuries back, is judged by today's morals. And I wonder if that sort of anachronistic moralism is another example of essentially escaping reality, that the West is trying very hard not to be rooted in the present day, where sure, you know, it's pretty developed, but its influence is waning. And it's waning not because Russia or China are aggressive, but simply because Western politicians are not doing the job of governing as they are supposed to be doing.
For me, another problem comes from the, let's say, from the liberalism or the capitalism way of doing, you know. That's the what the West called, you know, the fight for democracy. In fact, it's not a fight for democracy. That's a fight to impose the so-called rules-based order, which is not exactly democratic, because that's an autocratic way to impose its own values to others, you know. And but it's rooted in the mind of which is more materialist. And that's why, you know, since two, three centuries with the de-Christianization of the world, the de-religious, you know, of the Western mind, is rooted in, yes, let's say, ultra-liberalism. And for this capitalist, liberalist thinking, you have to, all the time, to have new markets, to develop new markets. It could be markets for industry, for services, for finance, but also markets of ideas. The markets for the liberals are not limited to physical goods, but also to ideas. So that's why, for the most extremist Westerners, liberal Westerners, they cannot, accept to be limited. They have to be permanently conquering new markets in terms of physical goods, but also on intellectual, ideas. And that's, I think, something very strong.
Now, you mentioned the idea of democracy, and we just had major European Parliament elections, the results of which, if I were a Western politician, would have been quite disturbing for me, especially when it comes to France and Germany, because I think what it shows is that this strategy of imitating governance, of, you know, paying lip service to the greatest ideals and not doing anything to actually realize them in practice, I think it's exhausting itself. People at large don't want that anymore.
If you see the results of the last European elections, you can see the growing importance of the so-called populist parties. And why? They are surging because they are not accepting anymore this kind of view. They are now realizing, they are now understanding that the Western elites are completely disconnected from the normal people, from the usual base of their own populations. And that's the biggest challenge. If, for instance, the political debate in the United States about Trump, about this January 6th rebellions against the institution, you know. In fact, that's just an upsurge from the people, very angry to see that they are not more heard. They are not more, they cannot express themselves because nobody wants to know what they are thinking, what they are wishing, what they are wanting in their life. And that's, for me, the biggest challenge for the Western politicians, to be rooted in their own reality. But as far as we can see, it will not be the case soon.
We mentioned Carl Jung, your great countryman, before, and he is well known for the concept of the shadow, splitting off certain parts that you don't like about yourself or your society, and, you know, projecting it onto others. And it could be an effective tactic for a little while, but long term, it's not sustainable, because at the end of the day, you can project as much as you want, but the problem with it is that your own inner problems, domestic problems, don't get solved and they accumulate to a point when they become irreconcilable, when, you know, collective psyches become too hot, too charged, and the people get, you know, very, very distressed. Do you see anything of the sort coming in the West? How do you think this conundrum of, you know, projecting all the bad things onto other countries and not yet satisfying your own populations will be solved by Western politicians?
Yeah, I think what is interesting and the rapprochement, to quote Carl Jung, what is interesting, I think now the West has developed a kind of pathology or mental disease. You know, for instance, Russophobia is a phobia. So in terms of psychiatry, that's a disease. Like all the phobias, you know, the phobias of the dark or the phobia, you know. And in that sense, I think there is a kind of a psychological or psychiatric problem. The problem is when you have such a disease, you are not aware of it because you say, oh, everything is okay. You are paranoid. That's the case. Oh, Russia is fighting against us. But in fact, it's not reality. Russia has threatened nobody. But this feeling of paranoia is so disturbing that, you know, now here the politicians, the European politicians, they say that. And that's a problem. How to heal, how to care, you know, of this kind of thing. That's why I think for many grounds, psychologically speaking, or economically, or geopolitically speaking, I think this, opposition between Western world and Russia and China and other the other part of the world will not stop, you know, soon. I think I'm not so optimistic because I don't see an end to this kind of way of thinking. You know, let's come back, for instance, to Ukraine. Now, I have heard that the European Union will start negotiation to include Ukraine in the Union. But if you look, they have to pay 100, there was an estimation published yesterday, 140 billions of dollars, you know, to pay. And it will, there is no money. The Western countries are very indebted, and they have to pay 140 billions of dollars just to pay for Ukrainian admission. So that's completely unrealistic. But that's the way of thinking. So
well, but Mr. Emeten, on the other hand, maybe that is the reality check that the West has needed, because I can tell you, being, you know, half Ukrainian myself, I know that Ukrainian people can bring anyone, you know, in connection with reality, not necessarily through positive means, but that is, if that is what they wanted, they can have it.
Yeah. No, that's the problem. The reality check will come one day. I don't know when, but it will come one day anyway. Yeah, you are right.
Well, we have to leave it there, but it's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you to you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.